I can make drugs. I could whip a batch tonight with my eyes closed. We'll make you trip.
Okay, Jerry. Why don't you just do that and bring it to school tomorrow and, we'll just see.
Decision. Where can I turn for all the answers? Who can I look to for help? Isn't there some kind of guidance deep down within myself?
LSD hints to us that there is an area of the mind which could be called unsane, beyond sanity, and yet not insane. That we could approach it by a thoughtful, wise study of LSD.
Has anyone here ever tried dope?
LSD opens up new vistas and experiences to those that take it. I believe that every healthy person should try it.
When Kevin Herbert has a particularly intractable programming problem or finds himself pondering a big career decision, he deploys a powerful mind-expanding tool.
LSD-25.
It must be changing something about the internal communication in my brain. Whatever my inner process is that lets me solve problems, it works differently, or maybe different parts of my brain are used,
said Herbert, an early employee of Cisco Systems, who says he solved his toughest technical problems while tripping to drum solos by the Grateful Dead. Herbert, who lives in Santa Cruz, California, joined 2,000 researchers, scientists, artists, and historians gathered over the weekend to celebrate the 100th birthday of Albert Hofmann, the Swiss chemist who discovered LSD in 1938. The centenarian received a congratulatory birthday letter from the Swiss president, roses, and a spontaneous kiss from a young woman in the crowd. The storied history of LSD as a mind-expanding tool began 5 years after Hofmann discovered LSD-25 and had what he described as a peculiar presentiment compelling him to resynthesize the drug. Without ingesting the substance, Hofmann managed to accidentally absorb enough of the chemical to experience its effects. In a second intentional trip, Hoffman said he had a frightening experience that gave way to feelings of rebirth. During the 1950s and 60s, LSD was found to be a promising tool for psychiatry and psychotherapy, and was studied by the CIA as a potential interrogation weapon. It was criminalized after it is... It was criminalized after it escaped the lab to be widely embraced by the youth culture. Like Herbert, many scientists and engineers also report heightened states of creativity while using LSD. During a press conference, Hoffman revealed that he was told by Nobel Prize-winning chemist Cary Mullis that LSD helped him develop the polymerase chain reaction that helps amplify specific DNA sequences. The gathering included a discussion of how early computer pioneers used LSD for inspiration. Douglas Engelbart, the inventor of the mouse, Myron Stolaroff, a former Ampex engineer and LSD researcher who was attending the symposium, and Apple co-founder Steve Jobs were among them. In the 2005 book, What the Dormouse Said, New York Times reporter John Markoff quotes Jobs describing his LSD experience as one of the two or three most important things he has done in his long life. Dr. Andrew Sewell, a psychiatrist and neurologist from the Harvard Medical School who studies alcohol and drug abuse, says most problems with LSD occur when users take an unknown dose they don't feel comfortable with in an uncontrolled setting without supervision to shield them from dangerous situations. Dr. Sewell says people who have underlying mental disorders should not take LSD because it could make their symptoms worse. Like any powerful drug, if LSD is used incorrectly, it can cause more harm than good, said Dr. Sewell. LSD is a potentially dangerous drug and should be taken under medical supervision. There is no evidence that LSD causes permanent brain damage, and quite a lot of evidence that it doesn't, said Sewell. We are lucky that we have over 1,000 papers written in the 50s and 60s when LSD was given to thousands and thousands of research subjects, so we have a pretty good idea at this point what it does and does not do. Asked if the world needs his invention, Hoffman said that he hoped the LSD symposium would create an appropriate place for LSD in society.
I think that in human evolution it has never been as necessary to have the substance LSD, said Hoffman. It is just a tool to turn us into what we are supposed to be.
So if there was...
I believe with the advent of acid, we discovered a new way to think. And it had to do with piecing together new thoughts in your mind. Why is it that people think it's so evil? What is it about it that is scares people so deeply? Even the guy that invented it, what is it? Because they're afraid that there's more to reality than they have confronted. That there are doors that they're afraid to go in, and they don't want us to go in there either, because if we go in, we might learn something that they don't know. And that makes us a little out of their control.
British scientists are beginning to debate the highly sensitive issue of using LSD for therapeutic purposes to unlock secrets buried in the unconscious, which may underlie the anxious or obsessional behavior of some of their patients. The UK pioneered this use of LSD in the 1950s. But psychiatrists found their research proposals rejected and their work dismissed once acid hit the streets in the mid-60s and uncontrolled use of the hallucinogenic drug became a social phenomenon. Some researchers have examined papers from the meeting of psychedelic psychiatry and think they may have modern relevance. They claim positive results in patients who were given LSD in psychotherapy to get to the deep-seated roots of anxiety disorders and neuroses. It took them, as the title of Aldous Huxley's book passed, from the poem of William Blake, through the walls of perception. Since the 1960s, when research was stopped on LSD,
Depression and anxiety disorders have risen to almost epidemic proportions and are now the greatest single burden on today's health services. Therefore, today's political climate may be just right for the medical profession to reconsider the use of psychedelic drugs, writes Dr. Ben Sessler in an as-yet unpublished paper with Amanda Fielding of the Beckley Foundation, which promotes research into the nature of consciousness. In the past 5 years, the international climate has been changing, albeit very slowly. In the U.S., Israel, Switzerland, and Spain, a few research projects have been limited to the effects of LSD, MDMA, and psilocybin, rapid bleeding, magic mushrooms on the brain. They look at the use of drugs in conditions such as post-traumatic stress disorder, obsessive-compulsive disorder, and the alleviation of distress in the dying.
Dumb stuff about chromosome damage. We would have seen all them deformed babies by now anyway.
That's basically what one side has to say in favor of LSD. Now let's hear what the other side has to say. Then we'll be able to make up our own minds. Let's hear from young people who have had their reasons for being down on LSD. Let's also hear from doctors, psychologists, and other experts who have tried LSD themselves. We've had a great deal of experience with LSD and the people who have taken it.
I first dropped acid when I was 18. I was over at these people's house one night. This guy I went to school with was over there and asked me if I wanted to try some acid. I had read about it in the newspapers and heard a few friends talk about it, so I was curious. I was pretty jacked up on marijuana, so I decided to try it, and I dropped it. And I told him, look at the thing, he's got a face, and he's screaming. And the guy finally looked over, and he got on the same trip that I was on. And we sat there carrying on a conversation with that hot dog. Finally, I decided I was just hallucinating, so I put it in my mouth and bit down. It screamed so loud that you could hear it all over town, so I had to throw it on the ground and step on it. And I was jumping on this hot dog in the middle of Market Street. That I had murdered it. And I took off screaming down the street, scared.
By the late 60s, LSD becomes public drug enemy number one. Anyone associated with the drug culture is targeted. In 1970, Timothy Leary is arrested for possession of marijuana and sentenced to 10 years in prison.
It is a very strong drug. On the one hand, you hear me explaining it as being this exquisite revelation. And on the other hand, I'm saying look out because you might jump out a window. That's the problem, is you never know
absolutely there are people in mental institutions that you can say that the thing that, the spring that put them there, the little vehicle they rode into that appalling state was LSD.
Hallucinogens alter consciousness and produce changes in thought, mood, and perception. True hallucinations are rare. More common are perceptual distortions. There is perceived mystical or transcendent effect. There are about a dozen natural and over 100 synthetic hallucinogens. Hallucinogens can be divided into three broad categories. One, those hallucinogens that are serotonin-like, LSD, psilocybin mushrooms, peyote cactus, designer hallucinogens like DMT, and amphetamine derivatives like DOM, TMA, DMA, MDMA, etc. Two, the belladonna alkaloids. And three, the dissociative anesthetics like PCP and ketamine. Belladonna, PCP, and ketamine are more physically dangerous than LSD and LSD-like drugs. LSD is the most potent hallucinogen. It is water-soluble, rapidly absorbed, and quickly distributed to all body tissues, including the brain. It is usually ingested in the form of impregnated paper or sugar cubes, capsules, and tablets. The physical effects of LSD are seen within 20 minutes. Psychoactive effects occur within 2 to 4 hours. Mescaline can be smoked, but this is unusual. The dried button of the peyote cactus is swallowed without chewing. The active ingredient is absorbed from the stomach and the intestine. The physical effects of mescaline are seen within 20 minutes. Psychoactive effects occur within 2 to 4 hours. DMT, a tryptamine derivative, is also called the businessman's LSD because it has a rapid onset and a short duration of action, 60 to 120 minutes. MDMA, MDA, and DOM have strong stimulant effects in addition to hallucinations. They are classified as hallucinogenic amphetamines. MDMA is a synthetic drug structurally similar to MDA and methamphetamine. The belladonna alkaloids, atropine and scopolamine, are the active agents in Jimson weed. Atropine is active outside the brain and is used in the treatment of asthma, stomach problems, and the diagnosis of eye problems. The dramatic effects on thought and perceptions are caused by scopolamine as it enters the brain easily. These compounds have been used throughout history as a poison, as often as for hallucinatory effects. PCP is both water-soluble and lipid-soluble. PCP can, depending on dosage, function as an anesthetic, a stimulant, a depressant, or a hallucinogen. PCP has a long half-life, up to 3 days.
Life I'm living is too fast for me. I gotta lay off that LSD. Yeah, this life's too fast, man.
Making friends with drugs, is it? I mean, mescaline crumbled into a tumbler of ether with a float of Percocet Jimmies. I'd wake up and then we'd get high. God, those were some good times.
Brainwashing, espionage, and mind control. MDMA, codenamed EA-1475,
was tested at the U.S. Army's Edgewood Arsenal in Maryland. However, unlike LSD or the ill-named truth drug scopolamine, MDMA was used only on animals. Thankfully, MDMA's military potential was not realized. MDMA's parent and longer-acting metabolite, 3,4-methylenedioxyamphetamine, MDA, was first synthesized in 1910 by the same two unsung Merck researchers who went on to create MDMA. MDMA differs structurally from MDA only in its additional methyl group attached to the nitrogen atom. MDA's own empathy-enhancing effect at low doses was explored by Chilean anthropologist and psychiatrist Dr. Claudio Naranjo in his private practice. Dr. Naranjo discusses MDA-assisted therapy in his classic The Healing Journey. MDA was patented by the drug company SmithKline French for use as a tranquilizer and appetite inhibitor. In 1958, human trials were conducted. Unfortunately, the compound was to prove too psychedelic for licensed clinical use, but MDMA was popular as the love drug in the counterculture of the 1960s. The identity of the first human being to take MDMA is not known. The drug gained prominence only in the late 1970s, tipped off by Mary Kleinman, a graduate student in the medicinal chemistry group he advised at San Francisco State University. The legendary Californian psychedelic chemist Alexander Shublin synthesized and taste-tested MDMA at incrementally ascending doses. Ironically, Dr. Shulgin had himself synthesized MDMA in 1965, but had not tried it, an error of omission he later did much to repair. The effects of a 120-milligram dose of MDMA are recorded in Dr. Shublin's lab notes. I feel absolutely clean inside, and there is nothing but pure euphoria. I have never felt so brave or believed this to be possible. The cleanliness, clarity, and marvelous feeling of solid inner strength continue through the rest of the day and evening. I am overcome by the profundity of the experience. In the first published scholarly paper on MDMA in humans, Dr. Shublin and Dr. David Nichols describe the effects of MDMA on the human psyche as an easily controlled altered state of consciousness with emotional and sexual overtones. The well-connected stepfather of MDMA soon introduced the drug to the wider scientific community. Some of Dr. Shublin's friends, notably Dr. Johnny Appleseed of MDMA and Joseph, were professional therapists. They in turn introduced MDMA to colleagues as a valuable adjunct to psychotherapy. Later, in 1991, Dr. Shulgin and his wife Anne published PiCal, in Ethylamines I Have Known and Loved, a chemical love story. PiCal describes the synthesis and systematic testing on human subjects of a range of novel or neglected phenethylamine research drugs. It also offers a uniquely sophisticated methodology for human psychopharmacology and the scientific study of mind as an experimental discipline. By the early 1980s, over 1,000 private psychotherapists in the USA were using MDMA in their clinical practice. MDMA was commonly known as Adam, an allusion to being returned to the natural state of innocence before guilt, shame, and unworthiness arose. MDMA was used discreetly. No one wanted a rerun in the 60s. Dr. Shublin himself reportedly felt MDMA came closest to fulfilling his ambition of finding the perfect psychotherapeutic drug. Inevitably, word leaked out. MDMA was profiled by the San Francisco Chronicle as the yuppie psychedelic. In Newsweek, Jay Adler likened his MDMA experience to a year of therapy in 2 hours. Harper's Bazaar described MDMA as the hottest thing in the continuing search for happiness through chemistry. Unsurprisingly, MDMA use soon spread beyond the couch and clinic to the wider world. MDMA's now universal brand name, Ecstasy, was coined in 1981 by a member of a Los Angeles distribution network. The unnamed distributor, quoted in Bruce Eisner's Ecstasy, the MDMA story, apparently chose the name Ecstasy because it would sell better than calling it empathy.
Empathy would be more appropriate, but how many people know what it means?
Condemned by purists as a cynical marketing ploy, the brand name Ecstasy is not wholly misleading. Many first-time MDMA users do indeed become ecstatic. Some report feeling truly well for the first time in their lives. In the early 1980s, American production of MDMA beyond the research laboratory was effectively controlled by chemists known as the Boston Group. Somewhat incongruously, MDMA was especially popular in Texas, where the Southwest distributor for the Boston Group launched his own commercial operation. Mass production of MDMA by the so-called Texas Group began in 1983. Supply and demand soon mushroomed. Ecstasy was distributed openly in bars and nightclubs in Dallas and Fort Worth. It could be purchased by a toll-free 800 numbers by credit card. Ecstasy could be bought in little bottles at convenience stores under the label Sassafras, a tongue-in-cheek allusion to the botanical origins of its precursor.
Concentrate on the finger, or you will miss all that heavenly glow.
In 1985, the drug warriors succeeded in having MDMA made Schedule 1. Schedule 1 is the most restricted of all drug categories. That is, MDMA had, quote, no
legitimate medical use or manufacturing in the United States. It lacked safety for use even under medical supervision, and it carried a high potential for abuse. But by then, MDMA's fame had spread across the Atlantic. MDMA had metamorphosed from adding the psychotherapeutic tool to ecstasy, the party drug. Ecstasy became associated with the birth of acid house music in the Spanish tourist resort of Ibiza. By the summer of 86, Ibiza was popularly known as Ecstasy Island. Returning tourists and disc jockeys took the message back home. The UK's rave scene was born. Hundreds of thousands of tablets were consumed each weekend in the famous Summer of Love in 1988. The Conservative government and its allies in the British press were aghast. A moral panic set in and a threat to the nation's youth. Early in the 21st century, an estimated several million people worldwide were taking ecstasy and allied research chemicals each month on college campuses, in high schools, and on dance floors. Purity varies. Perhaps 10 to 15% of tablets consumed contain MDMA as the sole active ingredient. Illicit knowledge of the penicillin of the soul is spreading rapidly around the world, but in corrupt and contemporary form.
Pink Opal.
Sonic and Stars.
Yellow Tulip.
Red Superman. White Man.
Ecstasy. It comes in all the colours of the rainbow and all the brands under the sun. Australians consume as much as 500,000 ecstasy pills each weekend.
Logos mean absolutely nothing. Here's an example. I mean, these were the green millenniums that were around a few years ago.
Paul Dillon of the National Drug and Alcohol Research Centre sees many ecstasy users buying fake ecstasy based on hype and fashion.
Mitsubishis were the first ones way back in about 1998 that were really very high-strength MDMA. They got a good reputation. All of a sudden, the market was flooded with Mitsubishis that didn't have MDMA in them.
Sensitive to ketamine, which is not always detected by the marquee reagent.
With the mark, quite often if we see an orange reaction with the marquee indicating speed, we may also see a brown reaction with the mandolin indicating ketamine. And gives an indication that you have a mixed. And if this came up as a classic purple-purple reaction, we'd say to them that this test indicates the presence of an ecstasy-like substance, MDMA, MDEA, or MDA.
A recent study published in the open-access journal BMC Neuroscience found that a low dose of ecstasy on its own yields no noticeable changes in the brain. However, when the user is exposed to loud noise for a few hours after consuming the drug, the same dose of ecstasy dramatically increases brain activity. And while the effects of even high doses of the drug normally wear off in a few hours, users who mix MDMA with loud music show alterations in their brains several days after it is administered. The study's lead author says ecstasy's effects are enhanced by relatively common environmental factors. We stress the potential danger for many substances that have been so popularly accepted as relatively safe owing to their short-term effects, he said via email. I think that these effects could be cumulative because the administration of the drug 5 or 6 days later is done by an organism that is still under the effects of the preceding administration. The researchers got their results by studying the effects of ecstasy on rats divided into 6 groups. Each rat was administered either saline solution, a low dosage of MDMA, or a high dosage of MDMA. The researchers then placed their subjects in quiet conditions or exposed them to loud white noise. The continuous noise was kept at a level of 95 decibels, the maximum intensity allowed in Italian nightclubs, and played for a single period starting 1 hour before administration and ending 4 hours later. The team attached electrodes to each rat's cerebral cortex and performed an electrocorticogram to measure the activity in that brain region. 3 groups showed a significant increase in cortical activity. The high-dosage music group experienced the greatest activity, followed by the low-dosage music group and the high-dosage no-music group. 1 day after the administration of the drug, the cortical activity of both the low-dosage music group and the high-dosage no-music group had nearly returned to normal. However, the high-dosage music group had significantly altered brain activity even 5 days after the drug was administered. The ecstasy had stayed with them for over 5 times as long as it would have without the 4 hours of noise. Rhythm especially becomes exquisite while in ecstasy, an anonymous user sent via email.
Part of the way music moves us is that it stirs our emotions, and ecstasy heightens positive emotion. So imagine the most sweeping musical crescendo you've ever heard, and then on ecstasy it's times 10. The user also mentioned that after using MDMA with music, he was unable to get the music out of his head and still remembers it today, several years later. He said even now, similar music gives him a quote-unquote flashback.
Doctors from London University have revealed details of what they believe is the largest amount of ecstasy ever consumed by a single person. Consultants from the Addiction Centre at St. George's Medical School, London, have published a case report of a British man estimated to have taken around 40,000 pills of MDMA, the active ingredient in ecstasy, over 9 years. The heaviest previous lifetime intake on record is 2,000 pills. Though the man, who is now 37, stopped taking the drug 7 years ago, he still suffers from severe physical and mental health side effects, including extreme memory problems, paranoia, hallucinations, and depression. He also suffers from painful muscle rigidity around his neck and jaw, which often prevents him from opening his mouth. The doctors believe many of these symptoms may be The man, known as Mr. A, in the report in the scientific journal Psychosomatics, started using ecstasy at 21. For the first 2 years, his use was an average of 5 pills per weekend. Gradually, this escalated until he was taking around 3.5 pills a day. At the peak, the man was taking an estimated 25 pills every day for 4 years.
That's expensive.
After several severe collapses of parties,
Mr. A
decided to stop taking ecstasy. For several months, he still felt he was under the influence of the drug, despite being bedridden. His condition deteriorated and he began to experience recurrent tunnel vision and other problems including hallucinations, paranoia, and muscle rigidity. When he was admitted to a specialist brain injury unit and put on antipsychotic medication, he did start to show some improvement.
Unfortunately, he discharged himself before we were able to complete the assessment,
says Dr. Kamuda Balabaduda.
We continued to support him, but he started to use cannabis again and he dropped out. We tried to re-engage him, but we lost him about a year ago.
Salt is a white crystalline solid. It looks white and tastes bitter. The compound is chemically stable. MDMA does not readily decompose in heat, air, or light. The optimal adult dose of racemic MDMA is probably around 120 to 130 milligrams, but it ranges from perhaps 75 milligrams to as much as 250. Pills sold in clubs often contain less. MDMA is usually taken orally as a tablet, a capsule, or a powder. Onset of action is normally within 20 to 60 minutes or so after administration. When MDMA is administered by the oral route, coming up is naturally faster on an empty stomach.
Taking MDMA causes both an increased neuronal reuptake inhibition of the neurotransmitter serotonin, and also, critically, its increased synaptic release. The consequent additional flood of serotonin in the user's synapses is soon followed by an increased release of dopamine, especially in the reward centers of the striatum and the nucleus accumbens. First-time MDMA users occasionally feel confused or anxious before the dose-dependent dopamine release kicks in. A transient hint of nausea is common when coming up. The user's peak experience or plateau phase after the exhilarating dopaminergic rush doesn't last much longer than 90 minutes to 2 hours. MDMA's primary effects wear off after some 3 to 4 hours. MDMA is sometimes described as a cross between a psychostimulant and a mild hallucinogen. Since it is a methoxylated amphetamine, MDMA is indeed structurally related to mescaline. MDMA's methylene dioxy group is attached to positions 3 and 4 of the aromatic ring of the amphetamine molecule. But hallucinations on MDMA taken at therapeutic dosages are extremely rare, and psychostimulants, unlike MDMA, don't typically induce a profound sense of inner peace. Thus, MDMA exhibits a different profile from both the prototypical serotonergic DOM, with its psychedelic 5-HT2A-mediated mechanism of action, and also from the prototypical dopaminergic stimulant amphetamine. MDMA's primary effects on the user are surprisingly consistent, unlike the wilder psychedelics such as LSD, psilocybin, or DMT. MDMA may feel mystical, magical, or sublime, but it doesn't feel weird. The drug's influence is highly controllable. MDMA tends to enrich the user's sense of self-identity, not diminish it. Dr. David Bickles suspects that the related phenethylamine enactogen MBDB, formed by extending the 3-carbon chain of MDMA to a 4-carbon chain, might prove superior to MDMA as an adjunct to psychotherapy. This is because Dr. Nichols' creation lacks significant dopaminergic activity. It's thus less likely to induce a distracting euphoria. A case can be made that MBDB is indeed a purer enactogen than MDMA. Yet as an empathogen, MDMA is unsurpassed and probably unmatched. MDMA's residual dopaminergic, amphetamine-like action contributes a euphoric warmth to the user's intensified feelings and also the desire and ability to express them freely. Functional analogs of MDMA may one day be employed in other kinds of insight-oriented therapy as well. Safe, long-acting MDMA analogs may prove therapeutic in the treatment of social phobia, eating disorders, and obsessive-compulsive disorder. No compelling evidence exists that taking a single 125mg dose of MDMA a few times a year is likely to cause any long-term harm to the user's mental or physical health. Nevertheless, even pharmaceutical-grade MDMA taken at moderate doses in optimal conditions is not a wholly benign drug. Deceptively, ingesting pure MDMA can sometimes leave the user feeling better than normal the next day, albeit tired and slightly spaced out. Beyond warm memories, this afterglow may in part be explained by MDMA's residual amphetamine metabolic byproducts. MDMA itself has a long 8 to 9 hour elimination half-life from the blood, and its main metabolite has 5-HT2A activating effects resembling low-grade LSD. But 2 days or so after taking MDMA, most users experience the serotonin dip, sometimes called the Suicide Tuesday. The dip ranges from the almost imperceptible to the markedly unpleasant. The functional deficit the dip reflects may last 10 days or more, in some cases possibly weeks or months. Tolerance to MDMA develops quite rapidly with steady use. If MDMA is taken several days in a row, amphetamine-like and eventually dysphoric effects start to predominate. Thus, MDMA is not addictive in the conventional sense. Taken chronically, it soon ceases to be rewarding.
You're listening to WFMU East Orange, WXHD Mount Hope, and WFMU.org.